The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2014 Annual Conference, copyright 2014. If you have purchased this recording, you are free to make multiple copies for your school's use. You may not sell copies of the audio or post copies on the internet. Order additional conference recordings from this year's conference or previous conferences at store.accsedu.org. Find out more about the Association of Classical and Christian Schools at www.accsedu.org. Thank you.
My name is J.D. Head, and today I'm speaking on the power of story to capture the Christian mind. Let's pray. Lord, you know what I should say, and you know what this audience needs to hear. I pray that you would guide my words, keep me from speaking foolishness, from lies. I pray particularly the audience would be kept from hearing them. Help us to hear truth, despite even what I may say. I pray that you will equip us to be more useful tools, better useful for your kingdom. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. The movie opens with a screen from a video game, a baseball video game, for presumably an Atari 2600, for those of you who remember what such things are. The grandson, played by Fred Savage of Wonder Years fame, is sick at home with something non-life-threatening, maybe tonsillitis, maybe measles, and he's clearly bored and indulging in that great devourer of time, the video game. His grandfather, the grandfather, played by Peter Falk, shows up with a present. The grandson tears into the package, only to stop suddenly, maybe I should say sullenly, and he says, "A book? That's right. When I was your age, television was called books, and this is a special book. It was a book my father used to read to me when I was sick, and I used to read it to your father. And today, I'm going to read it to you." Does it got any sports in it? Are you kidding? Fencing, fighting, torture, revenge, giants, monsters, chases, escapes, true love, miracles. That doesn't sound too bad. I'll try and stay awake. To which I have to say, welcome to seventh grade literature class. The genius of the movie about Wesley and Buttercup's true love and Inigo Montoya's quest for revenge and Fezzik's pursuit of employment in any place other than Greenland is less the story of the Princess Bride than it is the frame of the grandfather and the grandson around the story. We're not allowed to forget them. The grandson's attitude towards books is transformed. He goes from struggling to stay awake to demanding that every word be read, even the kissing stuff at the end. While this alteration of attitude towards books does my heart much good, it's less important and less inspiring to me than the final scene of the movie. The grandson has not merely been prepared to enjoy books, stories, as a form of entertainment that might rival either sports or video games about sports. He's actually been able to grow up into a completely new level of understanding through the story contained in the book. It's late at night when the movie ends. The grandfather has finished reading the entire book, cover to cover. He gets up to leave when the grandson stops him. "Grandpa, maybe you could come over again and read it to me tomorrow?" His grandfather pauses, smiles, and then he says, "As you wish. As you wish." In the context of the story, those are the hero Wesley's words to his love, Buttercup. And as we discover early on, every time Wesley says them in response to Buttercup's insolent commands, what he's really saying is, "I love you." In the context of the story, those words signal true love. Love that sacrifices, yes, but not merely a love of negation. It is a love of addition. It's a love that does not just sacrifice and die, but a love that sacrifices in order to live. The grandfather loves his grandson, and he sacrifices his time that he could be, I don't know, playing golf or video games about golf. I say he sacrifices his time and overcomes the obstinacy of his grandson to show him something new, to love him. And if the grandson wishes, he's willing to do it again tomorrow. That love is better shown in a story than merely described in an essay or a speech. Though maybe what I have said is a good summation of the message of The Princess Bride, what I've said is not a good substitute for it. Go home and watch it. That's why I'm talking to you today. I'm here to make an argument. That may perhaps actually be too strong. What I'm really here to do is to advocate a bias for story. In your literature classes, obviously, but also in your history classes, in your Latin classes, in your Bible classes, heaven help us, maybe even in your math classes. I wish to advocate the use of story because of its powers to capture the heart and through it, the mind. We are living in a postmodern, or maybe even a post-postmodern tribal era. And as one of our juniors wrote in her recent thesis, story is well suited to the apologetic requirements of the time. Like it or not, stories are the primary way of advocating and winning your points. We are conditioned, our students are conditioned, particularly to stories, seeing them, being won over by them, more so than perhaps rational, logical proofs. Logic should certainly not be ignored or done away with, but neither should story. The two can and should coexist. C.S. Lewis, among many, many others, thought so. Nor should this coexistence of logic and story be so alien to us. The style and modes of classical pedagogy, from the grammar school right on up through the rhetoric, lend themselves to using and appreciating the presence of story in the classroom. So let's define the term. What is story? Well, according to Webster's, always a good place to start, a story is an account of events, and that's not bad so far as it goes, especially once we begin to think about that seemingly solid word, account. A story accounts. It describes events. A story accounts. In other words, it gives reasons for those events. I'd like to push that definition a little further, though, and give a slightly longer, but perhaps a little more useful definition, at least for my purposes. I'd define story as the relation of events such that there is a beginning, a middle, and an end. I'll say it again. Story is the relation of events such that there is a beginning, a middle, and an end. That definition is most definitely a work in progress. Feel free to add to it, alter it, trim it. It does at least serve as a starting point, and though Aquinas, in the only joke in the Summa, quotes Boethius in saying that the argument from authority is the weakest, I will say that I am standing in agreement with Aristotle, who defined story in much the same way in his Poetics. The notion of a beginning, middle, and end points to the idea of story as a whole, story as complete. It does not mean that a story leaves nothing to be done, necessarily, considering the endings of those classics, The Empire Strikes Back or Pride and Prejudice. Both are complete. The central tensions have been resolved as Luke becomes a Jedi and as Elizabeth becomes a wife. Both do leave some unfinished business for the future. In the former, Han Solo must be freed from Jabba's palace, and Darth Vader must be freed from the Emperor's guile. In the latter, there must be children and more marriages and continued training for Mr. Darcy so that he can learn how to laugh at himself. Little tension or concern exists for either set of problems, however. The conflicts at hand are resolved, and these are issues for another day. The notion of relation, though, is where our work as teachers and parents and adults and humans is done. Relating is meant in two senses. First, relation refers to the idea of how the story is told, the words, the medium, the rhetoric. My son relates the story of his dream last night in the limited vocabulary that is available to him. Melville relates the story of a very angry whale and an obsessive captain in the vocabulary, both in terms of words and metaphors, that are available to him. A second sense of relation is also at work. How we choose to juxtapose events, or even which events to include or exclude in our relating of the whole, we choose and select every time we tell a story. No one tells everything that happened. A lot of events that happen even directly to us happen outside of our consciousness. When you ask your child, what happened at school today? You don't expect a description of every breath, every change in heart rate, every bowel movement. We expect some details, nothing being both the classic and classically unacceptable answer. But we expect judgment in relating those events that are most important to their day. Why do we do that? Because we want to know what happened, obviously, and how long the suspension for it will be, but also so that we can find out what they thought about those events, which we can tell by how they relate them, how they talk about them, as well as the importance, order, and character that they give to those events, their story of those events. We ask for the full story when they are in trouble or even when they are doing well, partly so we can judge correctly and partly so we can see how they've judged. Telling stories is basic to our normal mode of communicating. It's the first way we begin to take in and connect to the larger world. It's a way of connecting to the world that we do not outgrow, or if we do so to our detriment, because it's a human mode. It's a God-created mode. We grasp concepts, ideas, and events in relation to other events, in relation to events that have happened to us. Storytelling, story hearing, is a basic outworking of John Milton Gregory's 7 Laws of Teaching. Can't get away from that. The storyteller must know what he's talking about. The hearer must be prepared, engaged, attentive, ready to listen. The storyteller speaks of common human experience as a bridge to what he is talking about concerning the events, whether they happen in far-off Dagobah a long, long time ago, or in slightly less far-off Pemberley. There is some overall notion that the storyteller is attempting to convey some event or some way of looking at an event that will place it, as in Gregory's words, an act of force in the mind. As the storyteller speaks, the hearer engages in his mind, creating within his own head pictures and concepts that, though guided by the storyteller, are wholly his own. And with the best of stories, there is ground over and over for review. In fact, in many of the best stories, review is necessary to truly understand them. Furthermore, in many of the best stories, review is an enticing prospect. The best stories cause the grandson to ask his grandfather to come back and read it again. So what are the powers of story? What are they? How can we use them, or at least begin to use them? Let's talk first about connection. Let's actually talk about the French Revolution. Edmund Burke did, in a single, free-flowing, 300-page essay that would make a rhetoric teacher rejoice and mourn altogether. Burke's reflection on the revolution in France is not a story. It's an essay, an analysis of events happening in France a mere 2 years after the fall of the Bastille. With amazingly clear insight, Burke cut through the romantic rhetoric and saw the future course of the revolution, that it would end in horrific bloodshed and tyranny. Burke was not just a conservative curmudgeon poo-pooing the rise of populist government who got it right and now gets credit for being genius. Burke's grasp of history and philosophy and humanity taught him to see the central problem of the revolution, its reliance on abstraction as a replacement for tradition, evidence of its utter ignorance about how the human heart is engaged. Deep into the essay, he writes about the revolutionary government's plan to eliminate all traditional geographic borders and replace them with squares. He says, "It is boasted that once the geometrical policy has been adopted, that all local ideas should be sunk, and that the people should no longer be Gascons, Pickards, Bretons, Normans, but Frenchmen, with one country, one heart, and one assembly. But instead of being all Frenchmen, the greater likelihood is that the inhabitants of that region will shortly have no country. No man was ever attached by a sense of pride, partiality, or real affection to a description of square measurement. We begin our public affections in our families. We pass on to our neighborhoods and our habitual provincial connections. These are inns and resting places. Such divisions of our country as have been formed by habit and not by a sudden jerk of authority were so many little images of the great country in which the heart found something which it could fill. The love to the whole is not extinguished by this subordinate partiality. Perhaps it is a sort of elemental training to those higher and more large regards by which alone men come to be affected as with their own concern and the prosperity of a kingdom so extensive as France. France was to be the people's center, France their pinnacle, France their greatest concern. The nation would be unified and secure, the revolutionaries reasoned, once all the other distracting provincial statist identifications were removed with the stroke of a pen and the creation of a grid. But revolutionary France did not last very long, because the revolutionaries did away with normal connecting points for human hearts. As crazy and as nonsensical as the name Bumpville, Pennsylvania may sound, that actual place has a tremendous hold on my heart. It's the place that I grew up in, and that as a result I miss in the winter and I long for in the fall. Burke's point? We connect with places and people with whom we've had experiences. It's all very nice, but what does it have to do with story? Well, story, with its reliance on previously formed human experience and with its ability, through the telling of the story, to create new experience in the hearer, has a profound power to win the human heart. We'll talk about the dangers of this in a moment, but let's not deny or ignore the particular power of story to connect our hearts to the outside world, this world that's outside of us. Think of the first time as a child that you heard of Paul Revere's Midnight Ride. Didn't it make you glad to be an American? Or the story of George Washington praying in the snow at Valley Forge? What about the story of Eric Little? Didn't it make you want to both run and be a missionary? Burke's point throughout his reflections is not that we need to manipulate people's hearts in order to attach them correctly. His point is that hearts attach. That's what they do. They tend to attach themselves to the first things, the most familiar things. And the French government, with its lofty goals of equality and liberty and fraternity, was ensuring none of them because it did not appreciate the importance of the heart or understand how it functioned. As a result, the French people were left with minds filled with high concepts, but with no connection or loyalty or concern for their fellow citizens. A description, incidentally, that conforms well to the definition of the psychopath. Their hearts, unchained, unattached, went straight in the direction that all unchained, unattached, unconstrained hearts go. Hellish, bloody sin. As educators, we run that risk too, prizing abstraction and ignoring the heart. The abstraction is clear. The list of facts about a story is much easier to grade than the interaction with it. The list of dates, much easier to assign a number to at the end and thus categorize a level of achievement than the messy discussion about the events that those dates represent. Numbers are easy. People and the things they do, that's hard. It is incumbent upon us both to help our students move knowledge from the head down to the heart. That movement will strengthen both organs. When possible, it may actually be easier to start the other way around and begin with the heart and move from there to the head. For instance, I studied some of Euclid's Elements at a small great book school in Annapolis, St. John's College. There, I heard discussed the question of what would happen if we began to treat Euclid's Elements as a sort of drama, a story. The outlines are there in some ways. Each of the 13 books feels like, at least to a literature guy, feel like a chapter. Each proof and proposition, if you go and look at it, carries the force of an episode, leading up to some sort of dramatic revelation at the end of the chapter, which entices one on a little further. And the ending? Okay, well, it took me a year and a half to work through Les Mis, so Euclid's going to take a little longer. But still, the drama is there. And I know that I've connected more closely with Euclid and probably learned a lot more about logic and how to think logically than I ever did with just mere geometry. Simply telling the story of your course and repeating it is also one that can be used in any course, and I recommend it. I don't mean simply reviewing the outline of dates and goals and assignments that makes up your course. I mean identifying the drama of your course. When we read the Iliad, I require them to know as a rote fact that the Iliad is about the rage of Achilles and its consequences. When we read books 2 through 8, and he does not appear, I tell them, wait until book 24. When we read books 10 through 15, and he makes only a passing appearance, I tell them again, wait until book 24. When we read book 9, or book 16, or books 18 through 23, and they really, really hate Achilles, and they really begin to wonder how he could possibly be a hero, I tell them, wait for book 24. Then, when we get to the drama of Priam walking into Achilles' throne room, getting on his knees, kissing his hands, and begging for the body of his son back, they're ready for that moment. They may not understand it. I'm not sure I understand it, but they are ready to pay attention to it. And I have been telling them that story, a story about themselves outside of the story that they are reading from the beginning and through the middle. And now we're at the end. I have a definite sense of where they are and where they have been each time they wondered about Achilles. The event in book 24 becomes part of a personal story and thus has another layer of meaning for them, another way to attach to it. The same thing can be done in math class. What is the key event of your math curriculum? Is it the introduction of the quadratic equation? Where's the great climactic moment, or one of them, when they know that they've moved from mere math into real algebra, or from mere algebra into real calculus? In 8th grade Latin, is it completing the final chapter of Wheelox and moving into real translations of Caesar's histories? Can you continue to help them to see their place in this whole, in this event of this day, in relation to events of the past and events of the future? Even though they may not get a sense of the whole at the moment, when that big event comes and they look back and then look forward, they will have a better sense of attachment and thus engagement to the whole. Help your students to see their place in the drama. Where are they going? What have they overcome? Where do they fit in? How has God helped them? How will he help them? Story is not the only means of helping hearts connect to abstractions, but it is an excellent one. We ignore it at our peril. If Euclid's Elements is a novel, and I realize by saying this that I'm opening myself to charges of both mathematical and literary heresy, it is a novel because it has no characters as such. This observation brings us to a second power of story, its ability to communicate lives. In a story, a relating of events such that there is a beginning, a middle, and end, you get to meet people, the majority of whom you would never meet in real life, many of whom you'd never want to meet. Aristotle says that character is revealed through action. The action is described in story. Though we will never meet Alexander the Great, Frodo Baggins, or Abraham Lincoln, we know them through the stories, and through their stories, we can share experiences with them and better know them. In them, we can find models to emulate or avoid. That's a good thing. I will talk about it later. It's a second aspect of this communicating lives that I want to talk about. I'm more interested in this aspect implied by this particular quote here towards the end of Homer's Odyssey. But the royal couple, once they'd reveled in all the longed-for joys of love, reveled in each other's stories. The radiant woman telling of all she'd borne at home, watching them there, the infernal crowd of suitors slaughtering herds of cattle and good fat sheep while keen to win her hand, draining the broached vats of vintage wine. And great Odysseus told his wife of all the pains he had dealt out to other men and all the hardship he'd endured himself, his story first to last, and she listened on, enchanted. Sleep never sealed her eyes till all was told. We know people not only by their stories, but also by the stories they tell. After 20 years of waiting, and 20 years of journeying, after the drama of killing the suitors and cleaning up the hall afterwards, after the physical consummation of their love, delayed at least on Penelope's part for 20 years, the couple share their stories. It's a moment of such great and holy importance that Odysseus' patron god, Athena, talks to Dawn and persuades her to wait. In other words, Athena makes the day wait for this couple to have their conversation. That's why I got married. It's my ability to talk to Shannon, to tell stories to her, and to hear stories from her, as well as all the other aspects of conversation that so delighted me. I get that in the Odyssey. And Odysseus, when he speaks, he tells her everything, even the philandering. He tells it all, and she tells him everything, and he delights to hear it. You have in this scene the coupling, recoupling through sharing a story. My wife and I regularly review our coming together story for no other reason than that it ends very well for both of us, particularly for me. It was also how we connect with each other. The experiences of my day at school and her day at home become shared when we share them. It's how our students, too, know us. We should always tread with caution any path that may lead us to inappropriate intimacy with our students, but we should also not shy away from conveying which experiences God has used to best form us. For me to tell my students about our long 3-year search to buy a home and how God kept providing both cheap rentals along the way and grace to move, grace to grade, grace to teach, and grace to be overwhelmed at just the right teachable moments makes Bunyan's parable in Pilgrim's Progress about Christ's secret maintenance of the fire of grace more real, more palpable to them. The same Christ that acts on behalf of Christian is the same Christ that acted on behalf of Bunyan, is the same Christ who acted on behalf of me. So why not them? This story lets them know me, yes, but more importantly, Christ at work through, in, and often despite me. It is perhaps worth remembering that one of the first ways we know about God is through his stories. To paraphrase the American poet Archibald MacLeish, sometimes a story should not do, but be. Sometimes the relation of events with a beginning, middle, and an end is so perfectly done, so complete, that it may simply be worthwhile to wonder at them. Nigel was a second-rate painter, according to Tolkien's story, who was mostly interested in painting leaves, though he never managed to finish a piece. He did not do it to win fame or to win fortune. He did it for the reasons cited here by his fellow townsman, Tompkins.
"Of course, painting has its uses," said Tompkins. "But you couldn't make use of his painting, private daydreaming. He could not have designed a telling poster to save his life, always fiddling with leaves and flowers. I asked him why once. He said he thought they were pretty." "Can you believe it?" he says, "pretty. What, digestive and genital organs of plants?" I said to him. He had nothing to answer. Silly fuddler. It was pretty. There is room sometimes to stop there. When it comes to literature, I think that's the side on which we really ought to err. There is great value in appreciating the beauty of the flower. There is also great value in appreciating the beauty of the flower at the same time as we appreciate how God designed it to work. The dangerous place is in the transition. The place where we have dissected the flower to see how it functions and where we stop, forgetting that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. How sad to see stories treated, as they so often are in textbooks, as merely examples of clever techniques or of political expediency or of just numbers on the page. Instead, we should sometimes allow a story or a testimony or a history to just be beautiful. The observation of technique or lack thereof should sometimes be set aside so the story can just be wonderful. And as Aristotle points out in his Metaphysics, for it was because of wonder that men, both now and originally, began to philosophize. They began to philosophize. They began to be lovers of truth because they were enraptured by beauty. King Haggard did not wish to contemplate beauty. He wished to own it, all of it. And thus he set his monster, the Red Bull, to work rounding up every unicorn in the world until only one was left, the one that's mentioned here. Prince Lear is our hero. Schmendrick is the magician. The Red Bull is closing in on the last unicorn, and the wizard is standing there doing nothing.
"Do something,"
a hoarse voice said to Schmendrick. Prince Lear stood behind him, his face bloody and his eyes mad. He looked like King Haggard.
"Do something," he said. "You have power. You changed her into a unicorn. Do something now to save her. I will kill you if you don't." He showed the magician his hands.
"I cannot," Schmendrick answered him quietly. "Not all the magic in the world can help her now. If she will not fight him, she must go into the sea with the others. Neither magic nor murder will help her."
"Then what is magic for?" Prince Lear demanded wildly. "What use is wizardry if it cannot save a unicorn?" He gripped the magician's shoulder hard to keep from falling.
Schmendrick did not turn his head. With a touch of sad mockery in his voice, he said, "That's what heroes are for." Here we have the most widely understood power of story, and rightly so, the power to inspire, call us to greater things. Heroes understand fully that they have one life, and that one life is meant to be lived for that which is beautiful and good and true. If necessary, they are to die for it. Stories present in quite graspable ways norms of being, and not just limited to what we normally call heroism. Pride and Prejudice, for example, gives both positive and negative instances of marriages, and certainly calls us to be more like the Gardeners and much less like the Bennets. Plutarch's Life of Simon calls us to magnanimous living, giving freely of our time, possessions, and self. It's one thing to be called to a heroic life or to live in a happy marriage. It's quite another to see how it's done. Magnanimity is a wonderful concept on paper, but what does it look like, really? Stories provide not just a call to greater things, but also models for how it's to be done. What exactly does the writer of Hebrews mean when he says that we should lay aside every weight and run the race that is set before us? Yes, we can and we should examine and discuss the abstraction of weight and sin and distraction. But the writer precedes that injunction with, "Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses." And who are these witnesses? What is a witness? A witness is proof, an exemplary proof of what faith is. Like Abel, like Enoch, like Noah, like Abraham, called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. Proofs. These are models, like Sarah, like Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, Rahab, Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, and the time fails to talk of them all. The models of what faith looks like in frail and failing humanity. And then there is the greatest model of them all, looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith. The author expected that we already know these stories. He does not tell the stories at this point, but reminds us of the stories we already ought to know. He has delivered a lot of good theology and argument, but he has delivered it with the understanding and expectation that we will look to these models to better understand what faith is, and perhaps what it's not, and even what it could be. The author is calling the readers not to settle for less, but to strive after greater things. On a more mundane level, one way of making use of this power comes from your own relationship with your students. Make them aware of their own academic progress, again, where they've been, where they're going. In my course, the first essays in seventh grade are on Gilgamesh, and though they put in a lot of time and a lot of hard work, and of course, have excellent instruction, the results are almost always terrible. Those students work hard, but they're in a new era of writing, and they're learning more of how to write and how to organize and how to think. It's all new. In the eighth grade, which is a big writing year for not just in my class, but in many others, I found that a mid-year storytelling does them some good. Namely, I challenge them to look at what they've just written for me, whatever it is, and whatever grade they might have earned, and then go back
and look at that first draft of that first essay on Gilgamesh in seventh grade. They will all have improved tremendously. I can then point them to their end, where they will be not only this year in June, but next year, and then the next. A year ago, crafting 6 pages of coherent writing would have seemed impossible. By eighth grade, they've done it. The seniors, crafting 20 pages of independently researched thesis for Mr. Keener, were right where these eighth graders are now, and they are now where these eighth graders will be. That sense of their own story has proved tremendously useful. This academic event in the eighth grade is taking place here, in the middle of their growth, growth which they can see by looking back to their beginning. It excites them about the possibilities of their end. So, story. The relating of events such that there is a beginning and middle and end can provide models which show us how to live. Great concepts that we know we should value to call us to greater and better lives than we might otherwise dare. Story two can provide objects of beauty that, in their very contemplation, leave us hungry for more truth, to know truth, to live it out as God would have us to. Story two can be a means of capturing hearts, and through them, minds. This, then, is probably a good time to at least mention the dangers of story. Plato, in his story about a discussion called The Republic, raises the classic in the sense of old and in the sense of typical objection to story. Speaking among you folks here, since you won't inform on me to the tragic poets and all the other imitators, everything like poetry appears to be a corruption of the thinking of the people who hear it, all those who don't have the knowledge of how things themselves are as an antidote. In short, for those who don't already know truth, stories can mislead. They can capture our hearts, as Homer did to Plato, and overcome our heads. I offer no rebuttal to that perception of danger. Our hearts can be attached to wrong things, ideas, wrong people. Through the stories, instead of beauty, we can easily be induced to contemplate crassness. Instead of being called to greater things, we can be called to sin. My wife and I began watching episodes of ER last summer. And while the drama and the characters were very compelling and very interesting, and to some extent presented good issues and ideas about life and medicine and relationships that were very much worth grappling with, we began to realize that by the second or third season, we were unconsciously rooting for a married man to have an affair with another woman. And thus we were done with ER. Story is a dangerous thing. The meaning of a story is not always clear at the first reading or the second or the third, and I would argue it shouldn't be. A good story invites review, which is just another way of saying that a good story invites contemplation, thinking and rethinking, driving the pictures and scenes and characters further and further into our hearts and minds. So often, as with every human effort, there is a lot of the wicked mixed up with the good. And finding the borderlines between the too wicked, Lolita, and the just wicked enough, Brave New World, that can be offer too much opportunity to err. It might be better for us to just take this dangerous and tricky tool, and knowing that our master is, after all, a harsh master, just bury it in our tents, unused, until he returns. I don't think so. Obviously, to change metaphors, leaving the field to the enemy may be a way of avoiding defeat, but it's certainly no way of ensuring a victory. John Bunyan saw the need to write a defense of his own use of story at the beginning of The Pilgrim's Progress, one of the most widely read stories of all time, certainly in English. He, of course, could not know this when he was writing it, but he did know that people would be offended, not merely that he had written an allegory, but that he had written a story at all. He defends himself on 3 points, which I will summarize briefly. First, the use of story is not forbidden. His point being that nowhere can you find scripture, in scripture, that stories are equated with lies or as a form of rhetoric that ought to be avoided. Second, many people convey truth into man's heart through stories.
I think I can speak for many others when I say that the Pilgrim's Progress itself is a prime example of putting truth into man's heart through a story. Lastly, the Bible itself makes use of stories, both fictional, as in the case of Jesus, spoken parables, and historical. I'd say that's pretty good company to be in. As with so many other aspects of life, the problem is not the weapon, but in how you use it. In light of all this, though, I do wish to raise a problem from a different angle, the dangerous two-story, particularly for those of us whose academic responsibilities are to engage with story on a daily basis, the literature teachers. In the poem, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, T.S. Eliot's title character suffers from an inability to escape the mundane. Even great things like the art of Michelangelo are reduced to mere topics of analysis and conversation, not sources of inspiration themselves. In the end, he succumbs to this modern problem in the frightful lines, "We have lingered in the chambers of the sea, by sea girls wreathed with seaweed red and brown, till human voices wake us and we drown." Till human voices wake us and we drown. We can kill the joy, delight, the power of story for ourselves and for our students, rendering them completely toothless. There are a lot of ways to do this, but I'd like to deal briefly with just two. First, the academic urge, or maybe to follow Mr. Wilson's speech, we could call it the scribal urge. By academic, I refer to the urge to impress others with my educational acumen, my reading list, my intelligence, my insight, in short, my distance from the hoi polloi. And academic reading in this light ignores what books say in favor of what could be said about them. Beowulf is not read to engage with a story about a man who sacrificially loves his tribe. We engage in it in order to discuss Anglo-Saxon history. Topics are introduced not because they relate to the story itself and help us better understand what the author was trying to say through the story, but the story is introduced so that we can discuss something else. There is value in considering these opinions and questions about stories, but when stories are only being used as vehicles for opinion or self-promotion and ignored for their own truth, we drown them out. And the unique powers of story to inspire, to attach hearts, or even to just absorb and present beauty, those powers are nullified. We are drowning out the powers with a wash of analysis and opinion about events instead of being engaged by the stories. We need analysis. We need discussion. But we need first to establish what the story actually is on its own terms as we're best able, before we begin rendering opinions about them. The antidote to this scribal urge is a firm fixation on our desire to glorify God and to discover truth, not to impress anyone or to measure up to any other false standard. If my 5-book reading list seems paltry by comparison to others, it's always good to consider my students, my situation, and my goals. Am I concerned about the number of books I'm reading because I think that the students really could do more? Or am I concerned about the number of books I'm reading because I just want them to do more? Am I mostly concerned about the truths to be absorbed from the Iliad? Or am I just proud that I get to say I teach the Iliad and 8 other classical works, unlike those poor public school teachers who are stuck with Sarah, Plain and Tall? The academic urge is one problem. The second problem is me. I'm the overwrought teacher. I want the students that I'm teaching to appreciate everything. There is so much to see and to know and so much that they could understand that I am tempted to demand that they read 100 pages a night and 40 books a year on the theory that they have got to see all of Rome in just one day. The first temptation of the overwrought teacher ignores the frame of the students. It's unrealistic. We are to push and stretch our students. That's how they learn, and that's how their minds grow stronger. There is, however, a difference between loading 20 pounds of weight onto the bar for my 6-year-old son Jake to bench press and loading him up with 200.
Frankly, I'd like Jake to be able to bench press 300 pounds. It's part of my plan for paying for college. But rushing him into it without considering his frame is not going to accomplish anything. And it might just make him permanently skittish around the weight bench, if he survives it. The other temptation of the overwrought teacher is to do so much telling and so much introduction that I overwhelm them with information before they even get to the story. It becomes impossible for them to absorb what is actually happening in the story that we're reading. If given time, I will spend a week introducing Beowulf, a book that I love tremendously. I will talk about the history of England up until that time, starting with the Celts. I will discuss the differences, insofar as I know them, between what we like to call Old English and what's real Old English. I will go on and on about Anglo-Saxon culture and the codes that seem expressed in Beowulf, the roles of women and the place of the tribe and the relationship of the kings to the tribe and that whole posse comitatus thing that seems to be going on and on and on. You get the picture. If the first temptation of the overwrought nature crushes delight under the burden of work, the second acts like a fertilizer burn, overwhelming young plants with too much good stuff. So what's the antidote? Faith and vision. Faith that God is the one who is blessing the students, not me. While I have a responsibility for helping them to learn and equipping them for that purpose, God is ultimately responsible for the increase, whatever that may be. I should be under no pressure to produce results that lay well outside my responsibilities. I must set that burden on Him and hold to the vision of classical education. My seventh graders read 5 books a year, but by taking it slow and allowing them to grow into the ability to read and think about great stories, I'm ultimately setting them up to read more great ones beyond the curriculum. And they really often do, because they want to. We allow them the possibility of becoming lifelong learners when we give them space and time to learn. It's a vision we need to hold to. And perhaps vision is just what we need and what we've been given. Story, consistently, carefully used, prepares us to participate in the great story, the story of God's redemption of His people. Notice the way that fathers are to teach their sons about God's commandments. When your son asks you in time to come, saying, "What's the meaning of the testimonies, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord our God has commanded you?" then you shall say to your son, "We were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and the Lord showed signs and wonders before our eyes, great and severe, against Egypt, Pharaoh, and all his household. Then he brought us out from there that he might bring us in to give of the land of which he swore to our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God, for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as it is this day." The answer to the son does not begin with an abstract explanation of the nature of God and logical proof of his necessary goodness, kindness, wisdom, and so on, though such explanations and proof certainly have their place. The first answer to the son is about the meaning of the things, what happened, the story. It's about Israel. It's a story about us. God's goodness is evident in the story, which sets the stage for their farther faith in following his commandments, in participating in his story. In The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, Lucy is given the task of freeing the Duffelpuds from their invisibility, and she is forced to enter a magician's house and to find the correct spell in his book of spells. As she's reading through it, she comes across many interesting instances, including one spell for the refreshment of the spirit. The pictures were fewer here, but very beautiful. And what Lucy found herself reading was more like a story than a spell. It went on for 3 pages. And before she had read to the bottom of the page, she had forgotten that she was reading at all. She was living in the story as if it were real, and all the pictures were real too.
When she had got to the third page and come to the end, she said, "That is the loveliest story I've ever read in my whole life. Oh, I wish I could have gone on reading it for 10 years. At least I'll read it over again." But here, part of the magic of the book came into play. You couldn't turn back. The right-handed pages, the ones ahead, could be turned. The left-hand pages could not. "Oh, what a shame," said Lucy. "I did so want to read it again. Well, at least I must remember it. Let's see, it was about, oh dear, it's all fading away again. And even this last page is going blank. This is a very queer book. How can I have forgotten? It was about a cup and a sword and a tree and a green hill. I know that much, but I can't remember. And what shall I do?" And she never could remember. And ever since that day, what Lucy means by a good story is a story which reminds her of the forgotten story in the magician's book. So what is a good story? It's tough to say. Here it seems to involve dinnerware, weapons, and green hilly forests. What Lewis seems to indicate here is that a good story refreshes the spirit, moves, and energizes us. And when we get done with it, we'll want to go on and read it again, or maybe have it read to us again tomorrow. But that's the thing we're in, a story. Remember that precious passage in The Two Towers where Sam talks about stories? Now the heroes don't know how it's going to turn out, and he realizes that they're living it. He says to Frodo, "And we shouldn't be here at all if we'd known more about it before we started. But I suppose it's often that way. The brave things in the old tales and songs, Mr. Frodo, adventures as I used to call them, I used to think that they were things the wonderful folk of the stories went out and looked for because they wanted them, because they were exciting, and life was a bit dull, a kind of sport, as you might say. But that's not the way of it with the tales that really mattered, or the ones that stay in the mind. Folks seem to have been just landed in them, usually. Their paths were laid that way, as you put it. But I expect they had lots of chances like us of turning back, only they didn't. And if they had, we shouldn't know, because they'd have been forgotten. We hear about those as just went on, and not all to a good end, mind you. At least not to what folk inside a story and not outside would call a good end. I wonder what sort of story we've fallen into." Well, here we are. What sort of story have we fallen into? We don't know how our country, our schools, our families, our own lives will turn out. We recognize that we may have some victories along the way, but we may also recognize that sneaking, sinking feeling that things may be getting worse. Maybe they're getting harder. In our story, though, we also know that just as it gets blackest, and that may mean for us the black river of death, that just as it gets blackest, our hero will arrive, and he will save us. And we will discover that even at all the black, lonely times of our lives, he was saving us. And we will be amazed at his story, which is our story, which is his story. And that is the story about the cup and the sword and the tree and the hill. He will tell it to us over and over again throughout eternity. And each time he finishes, we will say, "Could you tell it to us again tomorrow?" And he will answer, "As you wish." It's a powerful story. Thank you.